are grateful for the good work of the Church Network, whose retired CEO just reminded me to turn the record button on. Thank you, Phil Martin, for that. I appreciate that. We are grateful for New Matrix. Jim Kitchens, one of their principals, is on. I'm looking to see if Deborah is on with us this morning. Doesn't look like that. Maybe she's going to join us in just a second. Actually, she's joining us right now. We're grateful for the Lake Institute for Faith and Giving, for Baptist News Global, for Truett Seminary and the Truett Church Network, for Gardner Webb Divinity School, and for the Charlie Kerr Center for Faith Leadership at Belmont University, in addition to the Center for Healthy Churches, the organization that I work with. Those are all church-facing organizations in their own ways trying to do this kind of work. So we're grateful for their partnership in making this webinar a reality. With that little bit of introduction, let me turn it over to Jim Kitchens, who's going to talk about our topic and our speaker this morning.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Yeah, for the month of September, we have been talking about taking the risk of holy experimentation, saying that as we enter into this fall and programs are opening back up and churches are doing more things in person, that we're still learning what the impact of COVID is on our life and ministry, and we're still needing to pivot and make changes. And we think it's a perfect time to sort of say, let's take some risks. Let's do some holy experimentation about what might the church of the future look like. Remembering always, the only failure that's a bad failure is a failure from which you refuse to learn anything. So risking includes the risk of failure, and that's okay. So we've had speakers on that have been talking in different ways about, well, here's something we're trying, or here's how I'm thinking about what this next period of the church's life might look like. And so today, our guest is Rebecca Simon-Peter, who is the author of the book, Forging a New Path, Moving the Church Forward in a Post-Pandemic World, which sounded to me like it fit right in the heart of what we're talking about this month. Rebecca is a United Methodist pastor who lives in a lovely place in Wyoming, but has a ministry that reaches all over the country. She is really passionate about spirituality and connecting people with their God-given powers to co-create with the divine. She has an outstanding group coaching program, creating a culture of renewal that focuses on energizing church leaders to reclaim their calling and to grow their ministries. Known for teaching leaders how to bring out the best in the people who frustrate them the most. I like that phrase, Rebecca. But her work transforms church leaders and the congregations they serve. When she's not empowering leaders, you can find her on her hiking trail with her dog, Bo, or concocting in the kitchen. That's hard, an alliterative thing to say, concocting in the kitchen to with her husband, Jerry. Rebecca, we're so glad to have you here today. Let me say before we begin our conversation, as Rebecca talks, if questions come for you that you would like us to pose to her, if you would please put them up in the chat, that would be wonderful, and I'll kind of moderate that if we have time toward the end of our session. Also, I'm going to put up links to her book, to her website, where her coaching and consulting practice is listed. And also, she always loves to put up give me some feedback link when she does a webinar like this. So we'll put that up, and if you might copy that, and give her some feedback after today's session. I know she'd appreciate that. So, Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here. Thank you so much.
This is a great ragtag group of Presbyterians and Cooperative Baptists and a few other hangers-on. And it's been a wonderfully ecumenical conversation that we started. We started this webinar right after the initial shutdown. And after the pandemic blossomed, as a way to say we all need to be helping each other figure out how to navigate this dramatic shift we're being forced into.
Yeah.
So it's a great group of folks. I was intrigued. I was looking at your website, and your website includes the statement, "It's time to dream like Jesus again." Mm-hmm. But tell us a bit more about that statement and how it undergirds your ministry and kind of leads you to the writing of this new book.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much. So first off, I feel right at home in a very diverse group. I was born and raised Jewish in a Reformed Jewish household, interfaith, became an Orthodox Jew, then had a Jesus experience, a waking vision that drew me into this path of discipleship and ultimately apostleship. So glad to be with travelers on the road. And the whole dream like Jesus thing is, you know, it occurred to me that in many churches, mainline and otherwise, that we see ourselves as stewards of the budget, stewards of the building, but we forget that we're actually stewards of the dream, what I call Jesus's big dream, which I think can be expressed most succinctly in the Lord's Prayer. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So that somehow we're being called to express in our corner of the earth what we think heaven looks like. Equity, justice, love, forgiveness, inclusion, humor, serving one another, whatever we think heaven looks like, what the scriptures point to, we're called to be stewards of that dream. And I think churches have forgotten that. You know, when I came into the church, it was already in decline. I didn't know that. I just thought I wasn't working hard enough. And I got disabused of that notion when I started putting in 24/7 and realized even that wasn't going to, quote, save the church. And it was a little bit later that I realized, oh, this isn't about working harder. It's not even about working smarter as much as it is. We've lost our focus on Jesus's big dream. So we've stopped risking. We've stopped dreaming like Jesus. We've stopped making a difference for the world. And we've just kind of come in on ourselves. Can we survive? Are we going to make it? Is this church going to be around for my funeral? How many of you have heard that? You know, are we going to survive? So we're inward focus versus outward focus. And we've just really stopped that risk taking. And I think people are overall are less interested in a self-serving, self-sustaining organization than it is in one that is willing to take big, bold, beautiful risks, even if they fail, you know, for the dream of them. So that's been my foundational thought for quite a few years now, that the church has forgotten how to dream like Jesus. One of the dreams, I think, is that we can be spiritually connected. In fact, I call people to advance from discipleship to apostleship. I think in the church, you know, we do a lot of talking about disciples who make disciples who make disciples, but we forget that Jesus called people to be his apostles. The first stage of that was discipleship, follow, learn, emulate, absorb, not only like what Jesus did, but how he did it. And the how he did it started with this internal faith that he had. So I think we're called to not only have faith in Jesus, but to have the faith of Jesus. Now, I know in some circles, that's radical. I think in United Methodist circles, it's radical. It may sound radical, but I think it's actually really radical to claim. I have the faith of Jesus. I think we're called to co-create miracles. I think that's what this is all about. I think that's what the consciousness raising was about, of Jesus's work. And that we're called to step into that, to not only be in touch with our physicality, our humanity, but our inner divinity.
Hmm. Well, as you were talking, I was thinking about David Bosch's book on the missional church, that whole idea that God sent Jesus and the Spirit into the church, and that the Spirit sends the church out into the world, as a different way of sort of talking about that continuing movement outward into the community. And I guess the question that comes for me there is to what extent do you think Christendom is one of the reasons that we lost that dream, that we got so focused on maintaining the institution, and might the post-Christendom era that we all realize we have entered might free us to reclaim that earlier dream?
It's possible. Not everybody's going to go with it, but it's definitely possible. And I think that the pandemic has given us this beautiful opening into it, because many churches have lost 50% of their attendance or 40 or 30 or 20% of their attendance. So in some ways, there's nothing to lose right now. You know, in other ways, people are going to be hanging on for dear life. Hey, we can't afford to lose more. But in other ways, there is nothing to lose right now. And to really experiment, as you said, what did you call it? Sacred experimentation or holy boldness?
Holy experimentation, yes.
Holy experimentation, yeah. So in the book, let me just hold up a copy if you haven't seen it yet, Forging a New Path, Moving the Church Forward in a Post-Pandemic World, available wherever books are sold, I'm assuming. And one of the premises here is that this is not the first pandemic that the church has been through. And so I looked at different pandemics, and I looked in particular at the bubonic plague, because that was a big one. And it happened over the course of 300 years. So you could almost see all the movements happening in slow motion, like you could really study it. This pandemic lasts about 3 years. That pandemic, 300 years. Now, number one, can you imagine wearing a mask for 300 years? No way. But it was a deadly, deadly pandemic. And, you know, the Protestant Reformation came out of that. The printing press came out of that. The spiritual but not religious movement came out of that. Now, it may have preceded that. But so much of the church changed. And that was, you know, a deep into Christendom, as you say, Jim, but also a massive shift in how Christendom was expressed, moving from strongly clerically oriented to much more laity oriented, from power being invested in the power structures to the Bible, you know, moving from the people to the text. And I think that we're at a similar point. We're at a very similar point, a point of opportunity, a point of opening. And I think that the spiritual but not religious have been telling us for decades, you know, we'd like more spirituality. We want more presence of God. We want more understanding of our own spirituality. We want more miracles, I think, is what people are telling us. We want sort of less bureaucracy, less dotting the I's, crossing the T's, less telling us how to believe and showing us instead what it feels like to have this connection, this divine connection, and what is possible when we're coming from that space. So in the book, I make a very strong case for paying attention to the spiritual, but not religious. Now, they're sort of, I would say they're the canary in the coal mine of Christendom's collapse, because they've been quietly and not so quietly leaving the pews for decades. And, you know, they're the people who came to the church potluck and never came back to reclaim the pie plate. You know, how many churches have stacks of pie plates and dishes with initials on the bottom? And you sort of look up and you think, who's JP? Or, you know, who are these people? Who do these dishes belong to? So we have the cultural artifacts, if you will, that they did once belong to the church. They have left, but they left with a message. And I think that message is ripe for the picking. Can we do more to reorient ourselves towards spirituality? So hope that answers the question.
Yes, it does. And it's interesting because we'll often talk about, well, it's the nuns and the duns. Mm-hmm. It's the folks who used to be key leaders in your church and for whatever reason got burned out, weren't being fed, and have left as well. And notice there was the church network, Phil, in its weekly newsletter today, put out sort of the latest word from Pew that now puts, they call them the not interested or not anything, is now at 31% of the American population. Mm-hmm. So it's while that group still may have kind of a one toe back into the life of the church, or they have a connection, or they have a memory, or they have a yearning, they are that sort of next circle around us with whom we can have a meaningful conversation.
Mm-hmm. I actually think, Jim, that the meaningful conversation needs to start within, and it needs to start within ourselves and, you know, internally, and then with our community of people that are still there, but primarily with the divine, with God. Not to beat ourselves up, but to develop that connection, because again, that's what people are telling us has been missing. And I'm not saying all the spiritual but not religious and the nuns and the duns and the not interested are going to come flooding back. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that it's actually an important and necessary part of the faith development cycle to take a look at one's faith critically and say, I think I've been believing wrong. I'm not sure I really believe in this anymore. And there's been tremendous work done on that. And I cite it in the book. There's been tremendous work done on this over the years. And to realize that this is not a failure of an individual's faith, and it's not a failure of the church for people to look at their faith critically and reject it before they come back in a larger way where they can hold all the paradoxes together and they can hold belief and rationality and logical and, you know, all of that. They can hold that together in a new way. That's an important part of the faith development journey. I think we've gotten to the edge of that. People leave and we think, oh my God, what's wrong with them? And now we're starting to think, oh my God, what's wrong with us? When maybe nothing's wrong at all. It's just part of the maturation of faith. We stop short of going all the way through that process. And the people who have gone all the way through that process, they're out in the community. The church has not provided a space for them to come back to. Maybe they've developed their own communities. I mean, I'm a member and have been for a long time of that whole world of 12-step recovery. And that is a hotbed of the spiritual but not religious. And I've heard story after story after story why church didn't seem interesting anymore. But also people who are both and I think I'm one of those both and spiritual and religious. And it's doable. I think what we can do is expand our vision of what faith looks like, what faithfulness looks like, and open that up so people anywhere on the journey can come and go without us calling them wrong or them calling us wrong.
Well, tell us a little bit about how these issues and the way you've wrestled with them personally and the decisions you made about your own spiritual journey. Tell us about how that led to the formation of creating a culture of renewal and why that was such an important work for you to take on.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So I told you I had this Jesus experience while I was in the Orthodox Jewish community. I had my hair covered. I was keeping kosher, not well, but I was keeping kosher, observing Shabbat, loving much of it, feminism on hold. And then I got into that Orthodox world because I'd had a God experience when I was in Israel visiting family. My Orthodox Jewish family, a big God experience, moved me into the Orthodox Jewish community. And then 6 years later, had another one, a Jesus experience that moved me into the Christian world. And I'm sure my family was like, what is going on with this girl? Every time we turn around, she's doing something different. But I was really paying attention to the promptings, as I understood them, of God. And so I wound up in the local church after speaking with my rabbi, who said, stay, learn about Jesus from the Talmud. It's like, I think I got to do more than that. I went off to the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. And there I got the call to ministry. I wasn't going to become a Christian. I was just going to seminary to figure out who this Jesus guy was. And I wound up in local church ministry. After I got the call to ministry, I thought, geez, I better start going to church. I better get baptized. I did all that. Seminary first, then going to church, then baptism. So all backwards, but that was my journey. I wound up in an African-American congregation, which was the most alive and interesting place I could find to begin to explore Jesus, and then was invited to be the associate pastor there, and loved it. Spent about 12 years in local church ministry, and that love went sort of to lukewarm, like still of the idea of church, but here I had this big, bold, burning bush experience with Jesus that got me in the church, and I felt like it all sort of devolved into refereeing kitchen fights, who's in charge of the kitchen? Should we have kids in the sanctuary? Who's going to clean up the scuff marks afterwards? And I say this with all love and respect, love the people, but it's like, is this what church is? Is this really what it's all about? So I prayed for God to give me a new call, because I knew this wasn't a career move. I knew I didn't go into local church ministry as a career move. It was the last thing I ever wanted to do as a Jew, especially. I didn't really want to be associated with Christians, but here was this thing and I couldn't ignore it. And when Jesus came to me in that vision, by the way, very Jewish looking, it's the only thing that would have worked. Curly, dark hair, brown skin, warm brown eyes, kind of short, and a lot of love emanating from him. So after 12 years in local church ministry, when I was praying for a new calling, God gave me a new calling, which was to help shape larger conversations in the church. And my background was environmental studies. I wrote books on the Green Church and Reduce, Reuse, Recycle, Rejoice. I wrote The Jew Named Jesus, you know, helping Christians unlearn Christian anti-Semitism, understanding what does it really mean that Jesus was a Jew. But the most calls I got for repeat work was leadership development. So I began to develop the kinds of programs I wished I'd had when I was in the local church. I told you, I tried 24/7. Let's see what's really going to help this church grow. I didn't know I was, you know, coming into decline, church in decline. And so leadership development. And so I began to understand some things. Number one, that I had been misjudging the people around me. I began to use the DISC profile as a way of understanding human behavior. And I realized I'm a DI, dominant, influent person. I like to get things done. I like to get the enthusiasm going. I like to have results. I like to get out there and make a difference. And a lot of the people that were left in the churches, because many people had left, were more concerned with steadiness and conscientiousness and careful decision-making and, you know, reducing losses. And so I had been misreading them. I thought they were people without faith. I thought they were people that I judged faith as willing to risk. They judged faith by willing to sustain. So I misread people, not intentionally, but I did. And then I realized, I'm probably not alone in this. And so the first part of my work in creating a culture of renewal is congregational intelligence. Understanding who are the people in your congregation? What makes them tick? How is that different than you? What ticks them off? How is that different than you? And the second part of our work in creating a culture of renewal is leadership smarts. I realize that most people lead from trying to avoid their fears rather than stepping out into faith, risking it all. Even if they are risk takers, they still have fears, fear of loss of authority, fear of looking bad. And so I wanted to teach people how to move from fear-based decision-making to faith-based decision-making. That moves people forward. And then how to dream like Jesus. How do you have a big, bold, kingdom-oriented dream where the church is not the recipient of the vision, but it's the agent of the vision for the community? And then the third part of creating a culture of renewal is culture shift. How do you get people on board with a vision? And how do you carry that vision through to completion so you've got a sustainable shift in the culture of how the church sees itself? I used to think, hey, get a big idea, gather a committee, have three meetings, boom, get her done. That may work for people with my pace, but that sure as heck doesn't work for folks that are cautious and steady and value stability, which is what many, many of our churches are made up of. Whether you're a Cooperative Baptist, American Baptist, PCUSA, United Methodist, that's who's in the church. That's who's maintaining the church. People concerned with loyalty, steadiness, conscientiousness. So this work is trans-denominational, and it's designed to really help church leaders reclaim their calling and learn how to frame things in a way that their steady, conscientious folks can hear, buy into, and move forward on. So, you know, my call was directly into the church and then beyond the church, and then helping other church leaders not feel so defeated by their calls, you know, not easily answered, and churches not, you know, being as vibrant and vital as they would hope.
Well, as I'm listening to you, thank you for that. That's really helpful to see how that blossomed out into an external kind of way of path for ministry and for congregational development and leadership development. But I hear you emphasizing, I hear you emphasizing the experiential, getting in touch with the God within, getting in touch with our own call to be co-creators with God. And so I wonder, what are the spiritual practices, spiritual disciplines that were important to you personally as you began this journey and as you sustain it?
What a great question. Such great questions, Jim. Thank you. As I mentioned, I've been a part of that whole big world of 12-step oriented recovery, and it's deeply spiritual. It's much less about the particular substance or behavior, and it's much more about self-reflection, surrendering oneself to a power greater than oneself that's self-defined, not doctrinally defined, being willing to look at where have I been wrong, where have I been resentful, where have I caused my own problems, And how can I make amends, and how can I be of service to people in such a way that not only do I have a spiritual awakening as a result of working these particular steps, but other people can experience me in a new way, and I can be of service to the world. So those 12 principles, those 12 steps have been hugely foundational in my life for the last 34, 35 years. And they've really formed the foundation. And I think that whole idea that God as you understand God, which is a really seminal principle within the 12-step recovery world, it says that one's understanding of God can shift and it can change, and it will, and it's not wrong, and nobody else can judge it. And at the same time, you have accountability, you have a sponsor, you got groups, like there's all this accountability, and yet there's this great sense of trust that one will have a spiritual awakening, one will connect deeply with one's own higher power, and one will grow and shift. As a result of that, one will take responsibility for one's wrongdoings, and one will make a positive contribution to the world. So that deeply reflective spiritual practice has been very powerful for me, and it's let me know that that's missing in the church. You know, we have some things we nod our heads to, we have principles, but there isn't really an expectation in the church that, hey, by the way, keep coming, you know, do this process, you're going to have spiritual awakening. We don't make any of those promises. And I think that's a missing. We don't make any promises about, you know, where it's more, here's what you better do. Here's what you should do. Here's how you show that you're a disciple. But we don't say that you're going to have this internal awakening of spirituality and a depth that you didn't have before. I think that's a missing. The Bible is just chock full of examples of spiritual awakenings, you know, and they're weird. And there's, you know, we've got guys talking to, you know, donkeys, and you know, you've got all kinds of, but if you really look at the whole Bible and you take away the moral do's and don'ts, which is how we tend to interpret the Bible, do this, don't do that, better do this, oh, you better not do that. If you take away all that do's and don'ts out of it, what you're left with is this wild record of spiritual encounters, spiritual awakenings, the ways that people understood God, very different ways. And I think that we have right before us this rich resource of delving into our own spirituality through the life of the church, regardless of the denomination. We have this record of spiritual awakenings. And instead of looking at do's and don'ts, what would it mean to enter that story? Now, things like Lectio Divina and things like that get us into the story. But I think there's even more than that we can do. So that's how my own spirituality has really led me to see, what else could the church experience? What could the church become? What could we practice? It's already in our resources. It's just not currently our culture or the way we do things. Right. And in creating a culture of renewal, we're always looking at the culture of a congregation. How do you shift a culture? My background being environmental studies, I'm really interested in interdisciplinary look at things. How do things overlap? How do systems work? So I've brought that environmental studies approach, that interdisciplinary approach, to the life of the church to look at how do systems work? How do you shift a system?
Thank you. I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, so you've got a bunch of pastors and lay leaders from churches around the country sort of watching and are going to be watching the video later. I think we all have that sense of, yes, we need to lead our folks deeper. We need to regain a much more experiential faith, especially as we exit Christendom and don't have that managerial responsibility for keeping the culture going. So what are one or two, three first steps you would suggest to leaders about? Here's how you can begin that process in your congregation, in addition to buying your book.
Of course.
We're willing for you to say.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, in creating a culture of renewal, one of our principles is that renewal begins within. You know, we're always looking outside of ourselves. Hey, how do we get kids to stop going to soccer practice on Sunday morning? Well, you don't. So renewal begins within. It doesn't begin by changing the circumstances around us. It begins within. And so I would say to church leaders of whatever stripe or variety, deepen your own spiritual practice in whatever way that is. Perhaps it's scripture reading, maybe it's running and communing with the divine, you know, whatever, meditation, whatever that may be. Deepen your own practice. Don't look out there for them to fix it. So that's one principle. Another principle that we teach is that your people cannot go farther than you can lead them. So if your people want to go farther than you can lead them, they'll either go around you and cause trouble or they'll leave. So if you want to lead a spiritual renewal awakening, again, begin with you. And then share that with other people. Because I think this is part of the authenticity that people are looking for. Share your highs and your lows with your own spirituality and what that looks like. And thirdly, I would like to, I use the example of Ezekiel and the Valley of Dry Bones. That guy, he was a temple priest when he got exiled. He was no prophet. He didn't know what was going to happen. He wasn't sure what was going on. And all of a sudden, you know, 5 years into this, he started to have visions and God began to give him visions. And I think that's sort of where we're at. A lot of us are like temple priests, like, I didn't sign up to be a prophet. I'm not really sure what the future is. But in that valley, that vision of the Valley of Dry Bones, God said, you know, son of man, O mortal, can these bones live? And Ezekiel's like, I don't know, God, you know, you tell me. And God said, yeah, they can live. Here's how it's going to happen. I'm going to, you know, there's bones that are very dry, by the way, which means very dead. They're very dry. And I'm going to put flesh and tendons and skin and all of that. But it won't be until I breathe the breath of life into this body, these bodies, that these bodies are really going to rise, where they're really going to have vitality and they're really going to have life. I think there's something in that for us. Right now, we're scrambling to get back, you know, the flesh and the tendons and the bones and the skin. Like, let's put together back what we think church looks like. But let's not leave out the most important part, which is this spirituality. So as we are inspired by the breath of God, you know, breath, wind, spirit, ruach, pneuma, in Greek and Hebrew, those three word meanings for spirit, that the spirit of God can really show up in three different ways. So here's what I think church leaders can do. The first thing is personal spirituality. Like I mentioned, get in touch with your own spirituality and out of that, encourage others to do that. So personal spirituality is I matter. That a lot has been missing in the church because we generally jump over ourselves to our neighbor matters, our neighbor, our neighbor, our neighbor. But if we love our neighbors as ourselves and we're not loving ourselves, man, I feel bad for the neighbors. I think that's part of what's happening. So personal spirituality. Secondly is communal spirituality, like spiritual community. And spiritual community says we matter. You know, as a community together, we matter. But it has to start with I matter. Then we matter. Then the third way that God's spirit inspires us is sort of visionary spirituality, which is the world matters. You know, I matter, we matter as a community, and the world matters. So all three of those. And that's where we begin to dream like Jesus and the church becomes the agent of transformation. I think a lot of what we've done in the church though is skip over personal spirituality, collective spirituality, right? To fix the world, save the world, bring the kingdom. And so we've skipped over these important steps. So I would say taking that three-pronged approach is going to be really important for churches to begin to make the shift. I matter, we matter, the world matters. Personal spirituality, communal spirituality, and then visionary spirituality.
Well, and you used the terminology earlier in your conversation with us about moving from discipleship to apostleship.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm looking for the tie there. And I'm thinking back, we had Andrew Root on with us from Luther Seminary in Minneapolis a few weeks ago. And he talked about that one of the most significant things the church can do right now, and probably one of the safest in terms of not getting a lot of blowback from people, is to start a significant community ministry. So to get out into the world. So talk with us about how that, what that apostleship looks like from a local church setting.
Yeah, I think the way we teach it in Creating a Culture of Renewal and the way I write about it in Dream Like Jesus, one of my other books that's available, is that the church becomes the agent of transformation on behalf of the community. That we stop focusing on trying to survive and fix ourselves. We stop focusing on church improvement plans and instead take our energies, be stewards of that dream, and make a difference out in the community. And I ask people, I think just how Jesus, you know, when he was faced with a person that was not well, didn't sit around and think, oh my gosh, look at all these symptoms. I don't know if I'm going to be able to deal with this. Oh, the guy's deaf. He's blind. You know, he's got demons. Oh my gosh. I don't know what to do. He didn't do that. He envisioned that person in their perfect, whole, and complete state, and then ministered from there. He knew where he was headed. I think we need to begin with the end in mind. What would we envision for our community? If the church was operating at its very best, how would the community be different? Now, I ask pastors and church leaders this all the time. You'd be surprised how tough a question that is to answer. Most people don't think about it that way. They just think, well, how do I keep the church going? Or what would a better church look like? But I ask the question, what would your community be like if your church was functioning at its very best? Some of the answers that have come through have been beautiful. One pastor in particular that I write about in the book, Dream Like Jesus, said, why, we wouldn't have hunger, like hunger would be gone. And so they developed a vision called A Hunger to End Hunger. They were in the most well-educated, wealthiest county in New Mexico, Los Alamos, lots of government scientists and stuff. And there were pockets of poverty. There were people who didn't eat at night. There were people who lived in their cars. And so this Hunger to End Hunger, what they did was they brought all these churches together to fill in all the gaps so that everybody had food. Well, out of this beautiful vision, which took a while to put together, they realized, hey, not all the kids are getting to take SATs and the ACTs, and not everybody's got a coat, not everybody's got shoes. And so the whole thing just blossomed and blossomed. And they had PhD folks and people living in homeless shelters or living in their cars in the same ministry, doing work together. That was kingdom-oriented ministry, because they said, if the church was functioning at its best, what would our community be like? Well, of course, nobody would be hungry. So that's the kind of question that we ask, and then it gives people a whole new view of what they could be for their community. So that's one of the ways that we live out that apostleship, which is, you know, really agency. And we, with apostleship, we talk about the five A's of apostleship. Apostles are anointed, appointed, authorized, and accountable ambassadors of God.
Well, let me, Rebecca said in the chat, said that learning how to deal with people who drive me nuts is what caught my attention.
Yes.
In this conversation. So just as maybe a kind of last kind of silly question, tell us a little bit about how this will help us deal with people who drive us nuts.
Absolutely, yeah. So I teach a principle called the platinum rule, and that's the golden rule, one up. You know, golden rule, treat other people the way you want to be treated, but the platinum rule is treat other people the way they want to be treated, meaning be paying attention to what triggers them, what gets them nuts, what is their pace, what are their concerns, and address yourself in such a way that you're taking their concerns into account and that you're framing things in a way that they can hear it. We teach a whole system for that. We actually have a workshop coming up called Platinum Rule Leadership for Changing Times. You can find it on the website, RebeccaSimonPeter.com, under online classes. But the platinum rule is really the way we teach people, using the DISC model, how to really understand the people around you, how to build platinum rule relationships so that you're reducing anxiety, you're increasing collaboration, and less polarization. I mean, my God, we live in maybe the most polarized time in the world. I don't know. But I'm really interested in helping people get along and bring out the best in each other instead of, it's easy to bring out the worst in people. It's harder. It's a skill. It's an art to bring out the best in people. And I'm especially interested. And you might even trace that back to the family I grew up in once upon a time, active alcoholism, my role in the family, you know, make sure nobody rocks the boat. Don't make waves. Well, I took all that good stuff I grew up with, the spiritual benefits of a challenging childhood, and, you know, brought it to bear in this work so that we can benefit from hard-won lessons of without being codependent, you know, without compromising yourself, without giving up yourself, without being a doormat, how to really build positive relationships that will work.
Rebecca, thank you so much for this conversation. It's just been delightful, and I love your energy as you present. That's encouraging in and of itself. Let me remind folks that you've got all those links to her website, her book, and her evaluation form in the chat if you want to make a quick copy of that before we get off. Matt, I want to give you a little time to talk about the series that begins in next month before we take our leave. So let me thank Rebecca once again before I turn it back over to Matt.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be with you, and I really appreciate it.
Let me add my thanks to that, to Jim's as well, Rebecca. Thank you very much. Not only is it great content, but you presented it joyfully too, which in the midst of kind of everything that's taking place around us, people who can sustain joy in the midst of that, that's compelling. Thank you very much for that. So next month in October, it's not October yet, is it? Nope, we got two more days before it's October. We'll be in the midst of a series called How to Put Your Foot on the Gas When Your Tank is Empty. So one of the things that we've talked about a lot in the post-pandemic timeframe for ministers, one of the things that we're hearing back from a lot of ministers is it's not like life turned on a dime and all of a sudden they were filled with energy and joy and vitality and raring and ready to go to charge in the midst of a context in which their churches, many people in their churches rightfully hope that the church can kind of restart the engines and kind of re-engage. And so how do you do that? How do you lean into this moment? What are some spiritual practices that will help you refill the tank? What are some spiritual practices that will help, or maybe some communication strategies that will help your church understand the context in which the ministers are doing what they're doing? So our goal is to provide four different answers to that question. So we'd love to have you back all the way through the month of October as we seek to answer that question together. So
thank you all for joining us today. Our thanks again to our presenter, Rebecca. May you have a good weekend. And yes, if this were October, you would be presenting, Matt, not me. So have a good weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Rebecca. This
was really Thank you. Great. It was a pleasure to be with you, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Good, good, good.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Good to meet you too. Okay, take care. Let me know if I can be of service in the future.
I will. And I hope some folks come look you up on your website out of this.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah.
You have any early to stop recording? I'm